This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Philip Collins and Paul Collins, welcome back to Sphinx Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You are the author of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an examination of epistemic autocracy from the 19th to the 21st century, and you co-wrote that together. And there's some very interesting information here on Freemasonry. Would you like to expand a bit on your angle on the Freemasonic Lodge?
Sure. Well, our basic examination of the Freemasonic Lodge, although its history goes back quite a bit further, our examination in the book begins with the British Royal Society. This organization was formed under a royal warrant from Charles II in 1662, and ostensibly the organization was devoted to scientific research and the broadening of human knowledge. However, a darker agenda takes shape when one examines the esoteric heritage of the group's members. Virtually all of the founding members were Freemasons, and Freemasonry, which has constituted the nucleus of many conspiracy theories and speculative research, is a secret society that adheres to an ancient occult tradition dating back roughly 6,000 years. Now, that tradition is the religion of the ancient mystery cults that originated in Mesopotamia, particularly in Babylon and Egypt. It was introduced to the East by the Aryans of Persia and basically provided the foundation of all the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. It also provided the theological foundations for Judaic and Christian heresies, specifically Kabbalism and Gnosticism. But the religion's mythology, in a nutshell, is as follows. In the beginning, all human consciousness was encapsulated within a singularity. Now, this singularity has been assigned numerous appellations. The Freemasons call it the group soul or collective soul, and that's according to W.M. Wilmshurst in The Meaning of Masonry, he being a prominent Masonic scholar. H.G. Wells, who was also purported to have been a Freemason, called it the mind of the race or the racial mind. And several other individuals, Emile Durkheim, Carl Hune, have all made allusions to this psychocognitive singularity that they all allege that human consciousness was condensed to at the very beginning. And it was this singularity that basically constituted the whole mind of the human race. But at any rate, this singularity constituted, according to the myth, God. And at some indeterminate point of time, the myth alleges that the singularity divided into a plurality. Now, like the Eden account of Christianity and Mosaic Judaism, this diaspora of consciousness into several individual entities constituted a fall from paradise. Now, notice, if you will, the overtly collectivist overtones of this mythology. Such a mythical framework also comprised Nazism and communism, which were essentially Marxism disseminated on the popular level under different appellations. But the myth portrays man as a god in the process of becoming. Now, at the point of apotheosis, individuality is obliterated and the collective is acknowledged as the supreme reality. This new man, which they've spelled with a capital M to connote his purported intrinsic divinity, has been presented by numerous ideologues throughout history. Hitler, for instance, called him the Aryan. Nietzsche called him, who was the philosophical progenitor of Hitler, called him the Übermensch. In communist Russia, he was called the Soviet man. But despite these various cultural variations, modifications, the myth remains universal. Well, in The Meaning of Masonry, Masonic scholar W.M. Wilmshurst reveals the chief means by which man shall achieve apotheosis. And you find this on page 47 of The Meaning of Masonry. I'll just read the quote verbatim for the audience. It says, quote, "This, the evolution of man into Superman, was always the purpose of the ancient mysteries, and the real purpose of modern Masonry is not the social and charitable purposes to which so much attention is paid, but the expediting of the spiritual evolution of those who aspire to perfect their own nature and transform it into a more godlike quality. And this is a definite science, a royal art, which it is possible for each of us to put into practice, while it's to join the craft for any other purpose than to study and pursue this science is to misunderstand its meaning, unquote. The occult process of becoming is basically evolutionary in character. Long before Charles Darwin even wrote on the origin of the species, evolutionary theory was actually the intellectual property of the Masonic Lodge. Evolution finds its spiritual correlative in the Hindu doctrine of reincarnation, which was imported to England by the British East India Company, and subsequently it was adopted by the Royal Society. John Locke, who was a Freemason and a member of the Royal Society, proceeded to refine the Hindu doctrine within the context of metaphysical naturalism, and the result was a precursory theory of evolution that received the support of the male members of Darwin's family. Well, a little later, Erasmus Darwin, who was Charles's grandfather and a Freemason, followed Locke's lead and delineated his own personal theory of evolution in a book entitled Zoonomia. Erasmus was also a founder of the Lunar Society, which was the organizational precursor to the Royal Society. But in turn, the Royal Society would promote the work of Erasmus's grandson, Charles, whose evolutionary ideas were premised upon the theories that he presented in Zoonomia. But Darwinism cribbed liberally from many of the occult doctrines comprising the ancient mystery religion. Its concept, for instance, of spontaneous generation is derivative of the Kabbalistic concept of the Golem, which asserts that life can be generated from lifeless matter. Darwinism's concept of progressive biological development is essentially reincarnation extrapolated into the realm of metaphysical naturalism. The Darwinian notion of a perfected species is, simply stated, the apotheosized God-man heralded by the occult doctrine of becoming. Now, of course, in a hierarchical system of evolution, some species are closer to perfectibility than others. And in The Descent of Man, Darwin reveals who he believes is lower in the evolutionary chain. And I'll read the direct quote for the audience. Quote, "At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphic apes will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man and a more civilized state, as we may hope, even than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as a baboon, instead as now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla," unquote.
Wow, that's quite harsh. So they're equating third world tribal people with primates or gorillas.
Essentially. While it's true that Darwin himself did oppose slavery, he believed that blacks constituted an inferior race. According to Darwin, there were substantial dissimilarities intrinsic to the intellectual development of men of distinct races. But Darwin was building on the evolutionary principles of his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who was in turn a Freemason. And that's where these ideas come from. This scientific racism really originates within the walls of the lodge itself. I'll give you one example. In a 1950 issue, September 1950 issue of New Age magazine, which was the official journal of the Supreme Council of the 33rd Degree Scottish Rite Freemasonry, I believe they've changed the title since then because of all the bad press that the New Age movement received. The author of an article in there named C. William Smith wrote, and I'll quote him directly, quote, "Looking back into history, we can easily see that the guiding hand of Providence has chosen the Nordic people to bring in and unfold the new order of the world. Records clearly show that 95% of the colonials were Nordics, Anglo-Saxons. Providence has chosen the Nordic race to unfold the new age of the world, a novus ordo seclorum, unquote. And by the way, novus ordo seclorum is Latin for a new order of the ages, or a new secular order, which is precisely what they had in mind.
But for more information, see your $1 bill.
Absolutely. But in actuality, this racist contention was nothing new. Basically, it reiterated the racialist doctrine of the Masonic Lodge. Now, understand that this is different from your common variety of racism. This is an intrinsic feature of the Masonic religion. It is also an intrinsic feature of the ruling class religion of America's Eastern establishment. Masonry purports to be a philosophical scion of the Knights Templar. Templar initiates were required to desecrate a crucifix either by spitting or ejaculating on it. And this act of desecration's relationship to racist dogma becomes clearer when one examines Albert Pike. Now, Pike was the sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry from 1859 to 1891. And the 1961 Masonic Encyclopedia, Henry Wilson Coyle revealed some very interesting details about Albert Pike. He wrote on page 620, quote, "In May 1866, a group of returned veterans and other young men of Pulaski County, Tennessee, undertook to organize a social or recreational society, the name Kuklos, Greek for band or circle, being suggested, which was promptly converted into Ku Klux and Klan, naturally followed. About that time, a body of bad Negroes and worse whites had begun a career of outrage against Southern whites, and the unusual social conditions prevailing caused Ku Klux Klans to be organized in adjoining states, and the development went into its second stage, in which it revenged some wrongs and committed others of its own. Albert Pike was the chief judicial officer of the KKK, unquote. Now, of course, Coyle fails to mention that this social or recreational society was an effort to reinitiate the Civil War and reinstate the slavery system. But you'll see now the relationship between it and the Templar Act of desecrating the crucifix, because one of the chief symbols that are tangibly enacted by the KKK was none other than the burning cross. The burning cross of the Ku Klux Klan is merely another expression of the Templars' ritualistic desecration of the cross.
Wow, so you see it's a clear and distinct connection from the Knights Templar through Masonry right into the Ku Klux Klan. And Albert Pike, people a lot they don't mention, was also a Confederate officer.
That's correct, and he had also put together an army of some of the more savage Indian tribes and had conducted several different operations that were considered so savage that Jefferson Davis actually broke the army up because of the outrage that was felt over what he had done. Today, the Freemasonic Lodge tries to deny this association between Pike Pike and the Klan, even though several pro-KKK and Freemasonic sources actually admit openly that he was a founding member. A pro-KKK historian and academic, Walter L. Fleming, for example, he pointed out also Pike's involvement in the KKK. He refers to Pike as the chief judicial officer. But another interesting fact that comes out of this is that this Masonic racist tradition would actually be transplanted in the American national security apparatus by none other than J. Edgar Hoover, who was a 33rd degree Freemason. It's interesting to note that there was a replication of Hoover's desk and his office in the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C., and it was set up there by Scottish Rite Masonry. This replication was just a few feet away from the resting place of Albert Pike. He was buried in the wall there at the House of the Temple. And having the resting place of Albert Pike and the replication of Hoover's office so close together, it semiotically suggests a lot of things, but one really doesn't need to be a semiotician at all to understand that this suggests that Pike and Hoover shared the same tradition. Hoover was also a member of the Kappa Alpha Order, which it can be seen as a sort of college affiliate of the Klan. The Klan adopted the oaths and rituals of the Kappa Alpha Order, and the order was originally named Phi Kappa Chi until Phi Kappa Psi protested that the name was too similar to theirs. So the name was changed in 1866 so that it had the initials K-A. And this was supposedly to attract people who were familiar with the old Ku Klux Adelphon Society. And the Ku Klux Adelphon, those words basically mean the Circle of Brothers, which ominously sounds like the name of the Klan's forerunner, the Knights of the Golden Circle. And Ku Klux Adelphon and the Klan had several rituals in common, and so basically the Kappa Alpha Order also claims that Robert E. Lee was its spiritual founder and celebrates the Old South, and so this seems to be part of Hoover's KKK heritage, which is, of course, part of his larger, overarching Masonic heritage. Hoover put his Masonic racism into practice with his endless persecution of civil rights guiding light Martin Luther King Jr. He did this under the pretext that King was a communist, and it is true that King did have communist associates such as Hunter Pitts O'Dell and Bayard Rustin. And these characters may have even had a bad influence on King, but King could hardly be described or characterized as a conscious agent of Moscow. And it's also interesting that that while he was totally bent on finding some kind of communist connection with King, Hoover had turned a blind eye to Kim Philby, who was basically the highest penetrating mole inside Western intelligence in the whole history of the Cold War. And the reason for this is probably in all likelihood because Kim Philby and Hoover shared the commonality of both being Freemasons. But Hoover even played a role in King's assassination. When King returned to Memphis to try to put things back together after a peace march had been disrupted by what was later exposed to be a COINTELPRO operation, Hoover approved an FBI operation to circulate a memo that criticized King for staying at the Holiday Inn as opposed to the Motel Lorraine. And King, of course, took the bait and went to the Motel Lorraine, and an unknown person identifying himself as King's advance man changed the booking to a second-floor balcony. It was originally on the first floor that King was booked to stay. And the room was wide open to snipers with open alleys, and the room's rear location also basically was ideal for shooters. And this FBI move gave the shooter an easy target. Who was the shooter? I don't know, except to say that it is doubtful that it was James Earl Ray. Ray was a poor shot while he was in the military, and a former FBI ballistics expert at the trial stated that Ray's rifle butt would have to be dug 6 inches into the wall to actually hit King. But Hoover's FBI contributed to the mess, and it's pretty much safe to say that Masonic racism had provided at least one motive for that.
Well, now Dr. King's family supports a lot of this theory. They no longer think it was Ray alone.
No. As a matter of fact, too, there was a group of Memphis citizens that were put together into kind of a jury of several years back that actually found that there was grounds for the belief in a conspiracy as well. And I find it interesting that Hoover is this Freemason, and that he is insanely energized against King the whole entire time, while turning a blind eye to Philby, who is also a fellow Freemason, who the evidence was much stronger against. And Philby's penetration of Western intelligence was absolutely devastating.
Now, it's very bizarre because Lyndon Johnson, who was also a Freemason, is who made Hoover lifelong permanent head of the FBI.
That's correct.
Which is quite shocking. So there's a lot of connections here, and you would think that someone like Johnson, who was, you know, for the Great Society and giving out a lot, wouldn't want anyone like Hoover to have anything to do with his administration. But, you know, I guess the lodge prevailed over, you know, what their particular agendas might have been.
Well, your loyalty to fellow brother Masons basically might cause you to overlook their individual flaws and the several different personality problems, I guess you could say. Hoover was, it's no secret, a very autocratic individual. And even if LBJ disliked him on a personal level, the fact that they were both members of Masonry might have caused him to... He might have felt loyalty towards the man out of that commonality.
Wow, that's quite amazing. Now, a common thing I've researched, and I want to get you two guys' take on this, do or do not the Masons worship Lucifer? Because there's a lot of things you see on the net and a lot of things you hear. What is your opinion?
Well, there was a quote that's been widely circulated that is attributed to Albert Pike, where he basically said in an addressing to a meeting of Masonry that Adonai was the god of darkness, the god of evil, and Lucifer was actually the god of light, and that the two were sparring off against one another, and that Masonry had to be preserved in its Luciferian purity. I'm paraphrasing Lucifer
right
now. I don't have the quote in front of me. And Freemasonry has tried to say that quote is attributable to one Leo Taxil, who was a fraud, basically a hoax kind of individual. He was he was a free thinker that was basically involved in a lot of frauds and a lot of hoax. But the problem with that defense is that we don't find that quote in any of Leo Taxil's works. I mean,
you'll find it in Masonic literature, though.
Yes, exactly. A matter of fact, a few years back, Anton Chaikin of the Lelouch movement, whatever you think of the, whatever, you know, good or bad things you might think
right,
of.
Right. Provocative figure, Lyndon Lelouch.
Exactly. We'll leave it at that. But he actually found it in the files in one of the Freemasonic lodges, one of their major libraries. He was able to find that quote. You figure that if this quote was in one of Taxil's works, that it would be plastered all up over the internet, the page number, the citation, everything, to show that this quote originated with that man. However, you don't. It's also interesting, even, I mean, without that quote, if you don't want to include it as a part of the body of evidence, you find that yet another quote that includes Lucifer in it, in Morals and Dogma, where he refers to Lucifer as the son of the morning, and to doubt him not. And this is right there in Morals and Dogma. There's never been a copy of that publication that ever came out that was devoid of that quote, that did not have it in it, that was missing it, where to where somebody could suggest that it was added by an anti-Masonic.
I know. It's quite amazing. The only other reference I know is Manly Palmer's Hall, Lost Keys of Freemasonry.
Yes, the seething energies of Lucifer.
Yes, they talk about having to deal with the seething energies of Lucifer and control them. Well, why would anyone who is Christian or from a Judeo-Christian background want anything to do with the seething energies of Lucifer?
Absolutely. I think part of the problem is, first off, there's a whole lot of confusion promulgated in no small part by Masonic apologists themselves. They changed their tune, you know, several different times. And of course, when you slap the derisive stigma of conspiracy theorist on anybody, it tends to stick. But also, a large part of the problem is that some folks have a sensationalized view of this form of Satanism. I think Father Malachi Martin probably put it best when he said that they're not your common garden variety of Satanist, which is the truth. Luciferianism does not depict Lucifer or the devil as a literal metaphysical entity. Instead, it depicts Lucifer as a symbol for the cognitive powers of man and man's potential to facilitate his own salvation through science, through reason, through all of the powers of his mind. And so it's a very...
they conceptualize it, in other words.
Exactly.
Right, yeah,
exactly. Well, it's a product, basically, of what William Sims Bainbridge, a sociologist, calls religious engineering. And basically, religious engineering is the practice of taking a religion and basically inverting and reconceptualizing its symbols. And in the case of Luciferianism, it's virtually what I call a self-eviscerating belief system, and that is, it literally jettisons all of its own metaphysical contents to the point where everything becomes analogy. Luciferianism basically depicts Lucifer. First off, it completely and totally rejects any notion of a Satan existing. Instead, Satan is considered a something of a slander, of a libel that was unfairly branded upon Lucifer by real mean, hateful Christians.
Well, this gets very sophisticated for things that don't exist and are supposed to only be mental constructs.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they go to great lengths to say, well, this is just a concept, or this is just not a belief, but just a tool to think with, and then they go about defending this as if it's a real entity.
Absolutely. And see, the problem is that now, you know, in the course of religious engineering and reconceptualizing a character like Satan, whether you want to acknowledge him as a literal metaphysical entity, or in the words of atheist and Masonic apologists, refer to him as just a figure of Christian myth, as they would put it. The problem is that in so revaluing this character, you can basically re-sculpt him along the contours of self-interest, and the picture becomes so relativistic and so amorphous that Lucifer becomes whatever they want him to be. And I'm sure that the adversary himself finds this belief system most useful, because typically, what is man going to do when he's given such elastic parameters to develop a belief system in? Well, basically, he's going to rationalize self-interest. He's going to rationalize whatever is convenient, whatever is expedient, and so, of course, Freemasons can then, according to to their own belief system, basically transform Lucifer into the symbol of humanity's, humanity's overall enthronement as God. And that's precisely what they do. That's precisely what they have done.
Yeah, it's kind of an auto-deism. They kind of...
Absolutely.
They make themselves God, which, if you look at it from a Christian perspective, Lucifer himself doesn't really care if you worship Lucifer or worship yourself, so long as you're not worshiping God, because
absolutely.
Lucifer wins in the long run in this deal.
That's absolutely
right.
Correct. That's an excellent observation, because... ultimately, as the old mantra goes, the greatest trick that the devil ever played on the world was getting it to believe that he doesn't exist at all. And in the case of Luciferianism, it's a remarkably insidious belief system, because you have the revering of a character there while simultaneously the rejection of his existence. It's very paradoxical, but yet it's quite effective, and it's quite an effective system for controlling its adherents.
Right, yet the figure, the name Lucifer, is still there. It's still apparent. You don't have to look very far to find it,
mm-hmm.
which is really the insidious part of all of this. Well, we're just about out of time, but could you tell us where we could get your book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship?
Sure. Well, listeners can pick up a copy from www.booksurge, that's all one word, booksurge.com. They can also get it at www.amazon.com and alabrise.com. And this is the expanded revised edition, which was published in 2006. It's twice as large as the version that was published in 2003. So that's the version that folks want to be looking for.
Very good. I highly recommend the book. I enjoy it. I read through it twice, and I'm going back and picking out some quotes of other people that I kind of like that you put in there that I didn't see before. And it's very, very good. Well, we're out of time altogether, but thank you for being on Sphinx Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Bill.
And I will have you back again, and thank you once more. Bye-bye.
Bye.